World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
In North Africa, the British have beaten off two Axis assaults before the Marat Line in southern Tunisia, and they've regained the initiative in the north. In Russia, the Red Army has expanded its grip in the region of recaptured Zhytomyr. The Germans say it was another withdrawal according to plan. In the Far East, American General Bissell reports the Japanese air challenges are dwindling in the India-Burma-China theater, and American planes have made new bombing attacks on the Japs in the Solomons. Now, for our first report from overseas, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Algiers, Charles Collingwood reporting.
This is Charles Collingwood at Allied Force Headquarters in North Africa. Field Marshal Rommel's attack on the British 8th Army in southern Tunisia has so far been held, decisively held, in the words of today's communique. There is no doubt here at headquarters that this German attack is the real thing. It is a major attack intended to defeat the 8th Army, and Rommel is using a large armored force. As you know, Rommel attacked at dawn yesterday, 6:49, to be exact. His main thrust was around the southern flank of the 8th Army position. Another attack was made in the center, a classic move against the defended line that has been used in the desert ever since Wavell smashed through in 1940. By 10:30 yesterday morning, it was apparent to the British commander that this was an attack in force. But the German move had come as no surprise. Montgomery was laying for Rommel, and the German armored forces ran smack into British anti-tank artillery. In the first few hours of the attack, Rommel lost 21 tanks. The British lost nothing. As the day wore on, the British guns continued to pulverize the German armor. This morning, the official word was that heavy losses in men and tanks have been inflicted on the enemy. Our own losses are negligible. The battle is still going on. At last report, Rommel was reforming for a fresh attack. But the 8th Army has shown no signs of weakening. And in contrast to this dramatic news from the southern front, the fighting north of there has been stagnant. The German attacks in the far north have practically ceased. An American patrol went into Pichon day before yesterday. Yesterday, German artillery fire from the surrounding hills drove it a mile out of town, but the Germans showed no inclination to follow it up. The clear implication is that the Germans didn't have enough strength left up there to dare do it. The whole center of the Tunisian battle is now down in the south, on the Marat Line. This is either the beginning of the end for the Axis in Africa, or it's the beginning of a long period of attrition. It depends on which way the battle goes. But anyway, it means this, that the decisive stage of the battle for Africa has begun. This is Charles Collingwood in North Africa, returning you to New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
What will the Admiral Radio of the future be like? Admiral designers and engineers are far too busy building radio equipment for the Army and Navy to answer that question now. But of this much, you may be certain. When the war is over and peacetime production is resumed, an Admiral Radio will still be America's smart set. The Admiral Radio of the future may bring you television in vivid Technicolor. It may, perhaps, automatically record a program for you if you happen to be away from home at the time it is broadcast. Yes, the Admiral Radio of the future will include the best of all modern discoveries. Right now, however, the important thing to remember is this. Your present radio must last for the duration. To make sure it does, ask your Admiral dealer to check it twice a year regularly. Don't wait until your set goes dead to call him, or you may be without a radio for some time, since new parts are often difficult to obtain. Your Admiral dealer, by making regular checkups, can anticipate trouble. If he sees that some vital part will soon need replacement, he will order it immediately, and probably have it in time to keep your radio in continuous operation. Call your Admiral dealer tomorrow ask him to check your radio twice a year regularly. You'll be glad you did. Now here once again for Admiral Radio is Doug Edwards.
General MacArthur today rounded out his report on our great victory over a 22-ship Jap convoy earlier in the week. MacArthur's communique says that of the 10 warships sunk, 3 were light cruisers, 7 were destroyers. Our planes scored 80 direct hits and 63 hits or near misses in sending the 22 vessels to the bottom. The Japs had about 150 planes in the action. Our men counted 102 of them definitely put out of action. As for new air action, MacArthur says one of our bombers raided the Jap aerodrome at Cape Gloucester, New Britain, and another raided Elexhofen above Lae on New Guinea. In China, the Japs are reported to have suffered considerable losses in fighting, which is still going on in Hubei province. In Burma, meanwhile, the RAF's bombers have made a very successful attack against Mandalay. They demolished buildings and railroad cars and started a number of fires. In New Delhi, Brigadier General Clayton L. Bissell, commander of the United States Army Air Forces in Burma, China, and India, said today that the monsoon season this year won't interrupt the offensive of his 10th Air Force against the Japanese in Burma and China. He said, "I've done many things which will permit the 10th Air Force to continue operations throughout the monsoon." He declined, however, to amplify on his remarks. Although it varies considerably each year in different regions, the monsoon season usually brings heavy rains and high winds to Burma and Burma from May until mid-autumn. Bissell said his forces during February carried out 70 missions comprising 490 sorties, during which approximately 400 tons of bombs were dropped, 28 Japanese planes destroyed, and a considerable number of enemy planes listed as probably destroyed. He said his force had repulsed 2 Japanese attempts to raid American bases in Assam Province, India, and that no American planes were lost during the month. Bissell said that he was paying high tribute to the brilliant leadership, both in the air and on the ground, of Colonel Homer Sanders of Texas. In Russia, the Red Army has made new progress in its drive to envelop the Nazi spearhead pointing toward Moscow. But now for a direct report, we take you to CBS Moscow, Bill Downs reporting.
Moscow time, it is now 9 o'clock. This is Radio Center Moscow, calling the Columbia Broadcasting System. 16 seconds to go.
We are sorry that our overseas signal from Moscow is unintelligible. Here is the news from the Russian front. The Russians, fresh from their victory at Jotsk, are driving the Germans down the icy road to Smolensk. Today, a Soviet communique reports the capture of more than 50 settlements on the approaches to the great base of Vyazma. And Moscow claims the slaughter of nearly 4,800 more Germans in the fighting for Jotsk. In a drive directly south of Olenino, 35 miles west of Rzhev, the Russians declare they've occupied several dozen inhabited places. The communique adds that the enemy is abandoning arms and equipment as he retreats. Berlin admits the fall of Jotsk, but it uses the familiar line that the city was evacuated according to plan and without a fight. The Germans report the Soviets are attacking relentlessly at Staraya Russa near the shores of Lake Ilmen. Moscow partially confirms that statement, declaring that Marshal Timoshenko's offensive on the northwestern front is grinding forward. The Russians claim the capture of a town where German counterattacks were beaten down. They say the Germans are using considerable air power on that front, but the Red Air Force is credited with shooting down 16 Nazi planes. In the drive toward the Dnieper River line, northwest of Kharkov, the Russians report the capture of 2 towns. In Western Europe, Allied planes appear to have given Germany an occupied beating along the attacks of the past week. And now we take you to CBS London, John Daly reporting.
After 10 consecutive nights of raids over Germany and occupied Europe, the RAF last night gave the continent a breather. But in every city and town in England today, The little people of the British Isles are making a holiday of a campaign that will keep the RAF well supplied with the wherewithal to keep on bombing the Germans until they cry quits. This is the second day of Wings for Victory Week here in Britain. London's quota for the week is 150 million pounds. Up to early this morning, 30 million pounds, about $132 million of that quota, had already been raised. And today, the money is flowing in. In Trafalgar Square, where a great Lancaster bomber is on display, it looks more like a July 4th celebration than a campaign to raise money. I have just come from there, and thousands of men, women, and children are listening to speeches, buying victory buttons and flags, and little stickers on which they may write messages for Hitler, since they are to be stuck on bombs to be dropped on Germany. Everybody is having a fine time. I could not watch the thousands there without seeing immediately how sure they are that victory is now definitely to be theirs. And I could not but admire the cheerfulness with which they give what little they have left to bring that victory closer. Today's London newspapers announced that the Ministry of Food's appeal to eat more potatoes and less bread is not meeting with too much success. And there are warnings that possibly Lord Walton and his ministry may have to ration bread and flour. However, even the food situation produces a little humor. Yesterday, a young lady walked down one of London's principal streets eating a banana. It had been given to her by an RAF suitor who had just come back from Africa. The papers carry pictures of the said young lady, surrounded by admiring citizens in sufficient quantities to cause a traffic jam. And one paper, over the caption, "To refresh your memory," prints a close-up of that banana. And now back to CBS New York and Doug Edwards.
Now back in our New York studio is a man who has seen action on another important war front, Warrant Officer E.J. Kahn, Jr., of the slick pages of the New Yorker magazine, and more lately of the not-so-slick jungles of New Guinea. You've probably read some of Kahn's stories of Army campaigning. He's home on leave from the Army life. Well, Mr. Kahn, you're an old Army man now, aren't you?
Well, I suppose you could call me that, Doug. I've been in the Army since July 1941. And now, 1941 seems like a long time ago.
You've seen a lot of overseas service?
Nearly a year in Australia and New Guinea as a private, sergeant, and warrant officer. And just before I left Australia, I was with your CBS correspondent, George Murad. That was only 3 weeks ago. He was in fine shape when I left him.
Right up there at the front lines, I suppose.
Well, I was just about as near to them as you can get in the jungles without finding yourself trying to pick off snipers.
You mean...
Let me tell you the story of the trip to the front lines we made last Thanksgiving Eve, Doug. Our job was to get a boatload of ammunition to a little village on the New Guinea coast, just east of the Jap positions at Buna. We had a little trawler with an Australian civilian as captain and a crew of Filipinos and New Guinea natives. We left about 12:30 in the morning, hugging the coast. But we hugged it too closely, and about 2 hours later, we went aground on the sandbar.
Wasn't that sort of a hot spot in which to be marooned?
It certainly was. I don't think we didn't realize it. We knew the Japanese patrol planes, you see, would be along at dawn. So our captain suggested that we take to a dinghy, try to row to a place where we could get help. None of us had any idea what the village we were heading for looked like. Finally, the captain admitted he was lost. He thought we had gone right on past the last American-held village, and then the next stop would be Buna and the Japs.
Cheerful thought.
Yes, and we faced almost as much trouble from our own men on shore as from the Japs. There had been rumors that the Japanese were planning to put reinforcements ashore in that area. And if we sailed in, we might easily be wiped out by our own men. Our Australian captain knew that just as well as any of us. And I can tell you he was getting pretty nervous. Finally, we sighted a village and decided to land. When we were about 50 yards offshore, I shouted, "Guard!" An American voice answered.
That was luck.
Wait a minute. We weren't out of our tough spot yet. We didn't know the password of that particular area. But we did know that the Japs can't pronounce the letter L. So we called out a word that has plenty of L's in it, and, believe it or not, it was just the right one.
That ended your trip?
Well, not quite, Doug. Then we went up to the front. We were within 150 yards of where Yanks and Japs were fighting hand to hand. But the jungle was so thick, we couldn't see a thing. Guns were clattering, and mortar shells were dropping close. Too darn close. Then we had to get back to our own base, a hike of some 20 miles. When we were passing our abandoned boat, Japanese planes came over. They swooped down, and in a couple of minutes, our trawler was just wreckage.
Well, you certainly are a veteran.
Well, I suppose so, but let me tell you that all of our men who went through the New Guinea fighting are real veterans now. They know jungle fighting. They learned it the hard way. And they also know that they're superior to the Japs at that game.
Well, it's certainly swell to hear that about our boys from a man who's been in the jungle with them. And thank you, Warrant Officer E.J. Kahn, Jr. And we'll be waiting for that new book of yours on your overseas experiences, which is coming out in 2 or 3 months. This week, America's heavy bombers dealt new blows to the enemy in Western Europe and in the Southwest Pacific. Our flying fortresses and liberators attacked Germany's submarine bases and dockyards, while their counterparts were helping wreck a Jap convoy off New Guinea. And this was not the first time the Axis has felt the blows of our big bombers. Now for a direct report on what goes on in a flying fortress 4 miles above the ground, Admiral Radio takes you above the Smyrna Air Base in Tennessee, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
I have just been handed a tiny slip of paper which says altitude 27,400 feet, temperature outside 35 degrees below zero, which translated means we are more than 5 miles above the ground, and of course, 35 degrees below zero is 35 degrees below zero anywhere you're unlucky enough to run into it. At 5 miles above the Earth's surface, you feel like a pampered poodle in the world's most beautiful doghouse. Above is a sky of blue that I, for one, just can't describe. It's beautiful, to coin a phrase. We are wrapped to our ears in leather and sheepskin, and we are all wearing the cutest muzzles you ever saw. These muzzles, of course, are oxygen masks, each molded to the individual face by Major Tom Carbine, who seemed a little upset to find that the Neanderthalic skull was so prevalent in the radio industry. You don't just wear an oxygen mask, you have a fitting. Actually, the masks aren't too uncomfortable. And as Major Tom Carbine says, if you want some real discomfort, take one off at 5 miles. Superman might retain consciousness for 30 seconds. I am in Captain John Heckman's B-17. That's a flying fortress. And many of the boys who are now running that commutation service to Berlin learn to handle these beautiful four-motored monsters here at the Flying Training Command's Smyrna Air Base, commanded by Colonel Stanley Umstead. From the bombardier's turret in the nose to the tail gunner's position, there are 9 highly trained specialists in the crew of a flying fortress. When the fortress is on the offensive, it is capable of flying great distances at great altitudes and dropping great numbers of devastating bombs. When she is on the defensive against interception, she carries enough guns sticking from her nose, her belly, her tail, her roof, and her windows to keep any Axis plane at a respectful distance. When these flying fortress crews are working at their normal posts, they take oxygen from a tiny pipeline running along each side of the plane and fed by cylinders. When they want to move around, they hook their masks to tiny bottles scattered throughout the ship and walk around. Mother Nature limits the time you can spend at these altitudes, but 6 hours is about par. If you're up here too long without sufficient oxygen, you get reactions similar to people who have had too much to drink. I understand that these kinds of persons sometimes get very happy and carefree, and sometimes get very hard to get along with, depending upon the individual. This might easily be the subject for another broadcast. I return you now to CBS in New York and Doug Edwards.
Within the hour, the Navy announced new attacks by our planes on Jap positions in the Solomons. For this report and news of a new selective service order, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington, Lee White reporting.
A Navy communique an hour ago reported still more American bombings of Japanese-held areas throughout the Solomon Islands. Fires were started at Kahili, Buin, and Balali in the Shortland Island area. The American base on Tulagi Island, just north of Guadalcanal, was bombed by the Japanese the night before last. 2 men were killed. Here in the United States, the Army has announced that 14 officers and men are believed to have drowned during maneuvers off the Gulf Coast of Florida. A landing barge in which the men were practicing ran aground on a sandbar during a storm, and the landing ramp was accidentally lowered flooding the interior. The War Manpower Commission has just abolished the special 4-H classification for men between 38 and 45 years of age. Accordingly, the Selective Service Administration has ordered local draft boards to reclassify men in this age group as 1A, 3A, 4F, and so on, but to append the letter H to the regular classification. Thus, a single man in this age group without dependents and in good physical condition will now be classified as 1AH instead of 4H. The purpose of the order is to induce men over 38 to enter farming. If they do, between now and May 1st, they'll be reclassified again into classes 2C or 3C and will be indefinitely deferred for military service. If they don't, they'll theoretically be liable for military service. Meanwhile, the draft boards have been ordered to defer all necessary farm workers, even if, by doing so, it becomes impossible to fill their local quotas. This means that more city men will have to be drafted than originally contemplated, for the Army and Navy are determined to fill their quotas on time in order to have 11 million men available for military service by the end of the year. Tomorrow, the bill to continue the Lend-Lease Act will be introduced into the House of Representatives, and there'll be a debate for at least 3 days. Everyone's agreed that the measure will pass by an overwhelming majority. The only debate appears to center around the proposal of Senator Gillette of Iowa to change the name of the act to the War Supply Act and to make it clear that no payment in terms of dollars and cents is expected from such aid to our allies. Senator Gillette also wants it stipulated that war supplies may not be used contrary to the principles of the Atlantic Charter. Other members of Congress would like to stipulate that at least 10% of all war supplies be made available in the future to our Chinese allies. Another bill which will be shortly considered by the House is a proposal to make the Pacific Ocean an American lake, in the words of its sponsor, by acquiring stepping stones of air and naval bases. The author of the measure is Representative Magnuson of the state of Washington, who says that Breckinridge Long, Assistant Secretary of State, and officials of the Navy Department have promised him their cooperation. Apparently, the State Department favors the acquisition of Pacific bases, but not of Caribbean bases, for Undersecretary Wells yesterday took occasion to deny that we have any intention of keeping our Lend-Lease bases throughout Latin America. Seismographic laboratories here in Washington report a fairly heavy earthquake just before last midnight, the source of which was apparently 4,500 miles south of here, which might put it somewhere in the southern Andes, possibly in Chile or Argentina. I now return you to CBS in New York.
That was Lee White in Washington. Now here's a message from our sponsor. In 5 months, United Nations submarines and warships have sunk or damaged 248 enemy supply vessels. Radio and electronic instruments played an important part in every one of these actions. Such instruments located the enemy vessels, told their exact positions, swung United Nations submarines into position to torpedo them. Many of these radio and electronic instruments, employed so effectively by our Navy and Army, are today being built by Admiral. Back in the days of peace, Admiral took pride in a record of achievement that brought many hours of pleasure and entertainment to countless Americans. Yes, and Admiral took pardonable pride in being the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. But today, Admiral workers are rewarded by a far different satisfaction, by the grim knowledge that the product of their skill and labor has become a potent instrument of destruction, an instrument that not only aids in seeking out the enemy wherever he may be, but helps in dealing those smashing blows that one by one hasten the day of victory. Wherever you find American soldiers and sailors, you will find also the American Red Cross. Caring for the wounded, supplying first aid treatment, training nurses' aides, operating recreational centers, these are the humanitarian tasks being carried on by the American Red Cross. Remember, the Red Cross depends for support upon you. So give to the Red Cross. Give all you can. And don't forget the Red Cross Blood Bank. Employees of many firms, including Admiral, are signing up for blood bank contributions as a group. WOW News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from the leading news centers of the world. This is Warren Sweeney speaking coast to coast for Admiral Radio. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.